BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Anita Rani and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4. Just to say that for rights reasons, the music in the original radio broadcast has been removed for this podcast. Good morning and welcome to the programme. Now, when we did our special programme on SEND, investigating the special educational needs and disabilities system, we got a huge response from you. There are so many questions around this subject. One thing that came out of our audience on that day when we recorded in the Radio's Theatre was someone shouting out loud as they listened to the Education Minister, Catherine McKinnell. It was around the issue of academies. Have a listen.
Everyone has a responsibility for the children in their area and have a duty to work together to make sure that every child gets the best start in life and every child gets that chance at their
and
education, which we want to see.
Come in there, Minister.
Academy. Yeah, that's right.
Yes. What did I miss there?
A duty to cooperate.
Not if they're at an academy.
There you go. So this morning we will be looking into academies and SEND. 79% of secondary schools and 43% of primary schools in England are academies. A little bit of information for you there. As usual, we would like to hear your thoughts and experiences and any questions you may have. Get in touch in the usual way. The text number is 84844. You can email me by going to our website. You can contact us on our social media. It's at BBC Women's Hour or WhatsApp or even voice note if you like. It's 03700 100 444. Also on the programme this morning, Lucy Hind, the choreographer turned intimacy director, and music from Kim Cypher, music teacher turned jazz saxophonist. That text number once again, 84844. But first, a new investigation has been launched by the Metropolitan Police in connection with the allegations of sexual offences by Mohammed Al-Fayed. The force is investigating more than five people who may have assisted him. The commander in charge, Steve Clayman, says police will look at what roles individuals may have played in facilitating or enabling his offending and what opportunities they had to protect victims from his horrendous abuse. Since the case first came to light, more than 90 new victims have come forward. I'll be talking in a moment to Emma Jones, a solicitor representing some of the women. But first, I would like to hear from Dame Jasvinda Sangera, a prominent human rights campaigner and the founder of the charity Carmen of Honour, which helps honour-based abuse and who has recently been appointed as independent survivor advocate for the women coming forward. Good morning, Dame Jasvinda. Welcome to Woman's Hour. I'm going to start by just finding out what your role actually entails as independent advocate for the survivors.
Sure. Good morning, Anita. Yes, so my role is, important to be clear, is independent from the claims process. That's the first thing to say. The role is independent. I do not have a duty or obligation, neither will I, report back to Harrods, albeit I will report back to Harrods if I feel there is a need to improve processes or, you know, to advocate what victims and survivors are saying needs changing. So from my perspective, it is additional to the claims process. Victims and survivors need to know that they now have an independent voice. I'm here to ensure that they have access to support. Let's be clear here. Harrods have accepted vicarious liability. Every survivor who is eligible for the scheme has access to a therapeutic support, an independent lawyer. They also have access to me in terms of having conversations. I've started my engagement already, and next week we'll be speaking to people. So I think the important thing here is, Anita, you know, this is not just about the compensation. Survivors, and I speak from experience, also want to see change. They also want to ensure that any processes that are developed for this purpose do not cause further harm. What I see fundamental to my role is to ensure whatever anybody does in relation to engagement with victims and survivors, that it is trauma informed.
And you say you don't have to report back to Harrods, but you are employed by them.
Absolutely. I am employed by them, you know, just as you are employed by the BBC. You know, one has to be employed. But the point here is those that know me know my track record in terms of standing up for and speaking on behalf of victims and survivors.
You say 290 women have come forward already. Do you expect that number to increase?
290 are in the process. I already said I do expect the number to increase. And that is because in my experience, victims and survivors out there have yet to report. Mm. This is a reported area. It takes immense courage who report abuse. So some people will be sitting on their reporting. I'm mindful of the fact that survivors out there, victims out there, may be triggered by what is happening here, you know, and listening to this. So it's important that, you know they have an independent option to be able to access somebody to speak through the process, to hear what their options are and what their choices are.
So here's the question that's been going around this morning with what's come to light with these five people who are being investigated. How probable is it, Jasvinda, in that this alleged abuse could have been carried out without anyone else knowing?
Well, I don't think that is probable at all, because the bottom line is that even if you look at Jimmy Savile and you look at other abuses in this area where individuals facilitate the abuse, you know, it happens because people look the other way, or people knew it was happening but didn't feel able to report. Or then you had those, like the Met Police were investigating, that actually facilitated the abuse in relation to access to these vulnerable young women. So, you know, people would have known. I want to be mindful of the fact that there will be people out there who probably did know and are feeling very unsure and were unsure about reporting. You know, I'm talking about, it could be a shop assistant, it could be a neighbour, it could be anybody. You know, it's really difficult to report and be a bystander, but though there's a distinguishing thing here. Those who facilitated it need to be held to account, because they played an active role in enabling this to happen.
Are there patterns of behaviour that you might see that perpetrators might employ to make others complicit in their crime?
Say that again, sorry.
Patterns of behaviour.
That
the perpetrators, how do you convince people to be complicit? Is it subtle? Is it controlled? Is it about people turning a blind eye through fear?
I think the first thing to note is that these individuals will identify people who are vulnerable. That would be the first thing. Or, you know, if we look at, you know, to get a job in Harrods was a big deal, you know, to get experience, etc. You know, there's an excitement there. And, you know, using things like, you know, their job prospects, using the fact that they could be promoted, using the fact that these individuals were made to feel a part of an organisation, only to then use that to exploit them. So, you know, these are strong women. We were talking about, these are strong women. You know, these were not weak women. But the fact is that, you know, their positions were used. And that's what the point I'm making here. But then equally, you know, what I'm already identifying is, you know, the Met Police make reference to the youngest victim being 13. Now, we're talking about children. Children are vulnerable. You know, so identifying young people, identifying people from the deaf community, for example, I've heard that too. So, you know, yes, there are patterns of behaviours, but equally they would have been targeting people that this man would have wanted to access.
Emma, I'm going to bring you in because you've been speaking to some of the women affected. What are they telling you that they need right now?
Good morning, Anita. What the survivors need is, the survivors that I've spoken with need to have power returned to them, basically, in order for the women to feel a sense of justice, is to have that power returned, because these are women who have been ignored for so long. A number of women have reported to the abuse to the police. They've been let down by the police, by the GMC, by the CPS. They suffered this horrendous abuse over decades and have felt powerless for all this time. So what do these women need? These women need the power to be returned to them.
We know when some women did come forward, nothing happened. Some of those investigations were carried out post the Savile inquiry in 2014. Why do you think, Emma, another powerful man was able to behave like this after what we learned from Savile?
I think because men like this haven't really been fully investigated. I know that post Savile, there was quite a specific inquiry looking into the NHS Trust, but it wasn't a wide ranging inquiry. And so there hasn't been that wide ranging inquiry, public inquiry, so that a chairperson can compel witnesses to come forward, compel documents, to look at systems across the board, to look at the GMC, to look at doctors, to look at the police, to look at Harrods, to look at various agencies that might have helped to place women in Harrods. We need a full and thorough public inquiry to have a real fact-finding mission so that accountability can be determined. And the most important thing, lessons can be learned, recommendations made that then the government will need to implement to try to ensure that something like this doesn't happen again. As you say, we've seen it with Savile, we've seen it with so many powerful men who also are able to use the law, who are able to threaten defamation. And we hear about slaps and NDAs. All of those things need to be looked into.
So, yeah, let's get into that a bit more on a more granular level. So you're saying, you know, empower, the power to be able to use what they have at their disposal. But, you know, what about people turning a blind eye? These are huge institutions with lots of people working within them. You know, what, moving away from the case a little bit, just trying to understand the tactics employed, if you like.
By the people within Harrods?
No, just within a system to be able to, by the perpetrator, to be able to get away with it.
Of course. Well, I think, as we know, that the police are looking into five people who might have been complicit.
Yeah.
And when they're looking at being complicit, facilitating, but also failing to protect women. So it's having this group of people, having systems in place who are able to feed into a mechanism that will allow a perpetrator to carry out this abuse for so many years. And I think, yes, turning a blind eye, as just Tafinda said, that there might have been people working at Harrods that were too afraid to come forward. That we've heard anecdotal evidence about when Al-Fayed was going to do a walk through Harrods, that senior or slightly older female staff would send the younger girls off to the stock room to do a stock take so that they weren't on the floor. Now, if you're an employee in a firm that's run by a very, very powerful, very rich man, it's going to be really difficult to come forward. So what people were doing, I think, as far as they were able to, were doing things like sending people to the stock room or suggesting they go out and got coffee or something, as much as they could to try to protect. But for the employees working within Harrods, it must have been very, very difficult when at the top of that chain was a man who was so rich, so powerful, seemed to have friends everywhere, and seemed to be able to evade any form of prosecution, even though reports had been made to the police that had gone to the CPS on a number of occasions, two or three occasions.
Back to the victims and the women at the heart of this, Jasvinda, your sessions with the women are starting next week, but I know you've already spoken to a couple of them. What are they telling you?
Well, the anxiety is palpable, that's the first thing I would say. You know, the experiences of shame, and it's misplaced shame, let me be clear about that. You know, the having to relive this experience, and, you know, I'm hoping the process is not one where they're having to retell their stories, because that in itself is painful. I do want to make a point, Emma, towards what Emma's just said, if I may. Harrods are very clear, there will be no NDAs. There is not an expectation for there to be NDAs. That's important, okay? No non-disclosure agreements. And also, I agree with you, Emma, the survivors need power returned to them. You know, their voice is significant to change. With every survivor that I engage with, I will be asking them what they need in this process and what does change look like for you. Equally, I want to ensure that they have a support network, because I'm not clear about a support network in terms of the peer network or a support group. These things need to be identified. If we are going to be returning power to them, we need to start with them to understand what does that look like. And the last thing I will say is, we have a whistleblowing culture. We need to ensure every institution is creating a whistleblowing culture that protects those who whistleblow. Organisations need to do that. And that will stop the bystanders standing by. They will feel protected when they raise their heads.
And you're keen to speak to all victims of Al-Fayed's abuse, even if they didn't work at Harrods. How can women get in touch with you?
Absolutely. So MPL Legal are the legal firm that are developing the compensation scheme process. You can go to their website. There's an email on there. It's contact@surviveradvocate.co.uk. I just want to impress upon you that all conversations with myself are confidential.
And Emma, the police say the investigation is about giving survivors a voice and they're committed to seeking justice. Does that reassure you or the women you're representing?
Unfortunately, no. The police could have been committed to giving women a voice a number of years ago. I think the women that we've spoken to need more than that. And just going back to a point that that's been raised before, in order to help the women, to the survivor network, one of the other incredibly beneficial things that comes out of a public inquiry, and I know this from experience through working on infected blood, is the cathartic process that survivors can go through. And so many people who had been infected blood, thought they were alone, thought, this has only happened to me. And yet through that process, they came together, they're able to share their stories, share their experiences, and form this really strong common bond, knowing that they were pushing and pushing and pushing and hopefully going to make changes to the system.
Jaswinda Sanghera and Emma, thank you so much for speaking to me about this morning. That was Dame Jaswinda Sanghera and Emma Jones, who's a solicitor representing some of the women. And I must add that if you have been affected by anything you've heard, you can find links for support on the BBC Action Line website. And the Metropolitan Police have said in a statement, "We are aware that past events may have impacted the public's trust and confidence in our approach, and we're determined to rebuild that trust by addressing these allegations with integrity and thoroughness." 84844 is the number to text. Now, Lucy Hind may not be a familiar name to many of you, but if you are a theatre fan, you'll have undoubtedly heard of some of the productions she's worked on. Girl from the North Country, Oliver, My Fair Lady, Secret Life of Bees, and more recently, Groundhog Day. Lucy is a choreographer and in the last few years also an intimacy director. Her current project has just opened at the Royal Exchange Theatre in Manchester. Spend, Spend, Spend is the story of Viv Nicholson, who went on a very public, lavish spending spree, splashing out on furs, cars, champagne and parties until it all came crashing down around having won the football pools in the 1960s. Some of you may remember the story. Today's equivalent, she won around, today's equivalent, a few million pounds. Lucy joins me now from Manchester. Welcome to Woman's Hour.
Ah, lovely to chat. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, our pleasure. Let's start by, I didn't know about Viv Nicholson. There's like a bit of a generational divide in the office where loads of our people at Woman's Hour are like, oh my God, Viv Nicholson. So tell us a bit about a working class Yorkshire lass and quite a character by all accounts.
Yeah, really an extraordinary woman. It came from kind of really humble roots in Castleford. And she gets married really young. She's sort of 17, gets pregnant when she's 16, and has this real sense that she wants to break the expectations of what her life is set up for her. She's a really kind of working class mining community. And when in the 60s, she wins this enormous amount of money. And we really see her leaning into the possibility that this can give her for a very different kind of life. And she also really intrigued the general public by, at her first press conference when she won the money, by saying she was just going to spend it all. And then people really followed her through her journey in that. And she did fulfill that promise. Her and her husband, Keith, went on to spend it all.
What did they spend it on?
I mean, everything from a big fancy house, many, many cars. They went on many holidays. I think it's everything that we think, God, if I ever won the lottery, what would I spend it on? Those dreams. And then we get really sensible and we think actually what we would do. And they didn't do that. And I think that really fascinated people, especially at the time in the 60s, in the community they came from. And as a woman, having that ambition to want to change, what was expected of her.
And why did the British public get so invested in her story? What impact did it have on our psyche?
I think there is a fascination of what we would want to do with it. I also think it's one of two things. I think, like I said, as a woman, I think there was an expectation of how miners' wives, daughters, mothers should behave. And she just didn't do that. And then I also think we are intrigued by what that means for our own choices. So we have these rules by which we live that makes us good and sensible. And then we see someone doing the opposite. And either we are inspired by that or we resent it a little bit.
We resent it because we resent it because there's something in us that would want to do the same, right?
Yeah.
That's the resentment.
Yeah,
and also, how dare she as a woman, a working class Yorkshire woman, have a great time with a load of money? Is there something of that going on?
Exactly. And then when it falls and then we go, see, told you so. We're right. Don't take any risks.
Oh, we're awful, aren't we? What's your role on this brilliant production then? Spend.
So I've had a brilliant time. I'm the choreographer, so I get to do all the dance moves. And it's such a big, bright Christmas show. You get to put all your favourite moves in at Christmas. And then I've also been the intimacy director on the show.
Yes, this is interesting. So tell us what that role is. What does it mean? We've talked about intimacy directors on the programme before, but not specifically around theatre. What have you been doing?
It's slightly different to a TV and film role. I think that's called an intimacy coordinator. In theatre, it's very much about making sure that the actors feel like they don't have to take responsibility for the intimacy. So they don't have to be choreographing it themselves. They don't have to bring their own personal experience, because traditionally that's kind of what we've done with this area. It's a very new role. And I like to think of it like it's fight directing or choreography. Like, we'd never say to an actor, oh, you know what it's like to be in a pub fight. Why don't you guys just get on with it? And we kind of do that with intimacy. So it's my role to go in and set up a consent-based room. So it's really basic. We're just asking each other before we do things. We're getting permission. We're understanding each other's boundaries. I then choreograph those moves like it is a dance. We then have a document that makes sure it's set. So if it ever changes, if anybody starts to feel like that's shifting, we can come back to that document. And then if a cover or an understudy ever goes on, they have a set of blocking and moves that they can adhere to as well.
And are the actors always willing to be part of it? I presume. I'm thinking about, you know, people who have been doing this for you know, decades and have an instinct and have been in the theatre. Like, how are people adapting to this new way of doing things?
It's really mixed. I mean, generally, it's really positive. I think anything that helps an actor feel like they can do their job well, that they're comfortable, that they're in an environment that they're safe. But I think there is sometimes an implied tone that maybe the room isn't safe if I'm there, and I'm there to kind of police their behavior. And I think that makes them afraid they're going to get it wrong. I think some people may fear that I will take away their spontaneity and their chemistry. But for me, it's really about creating a space, rather than saying, here are a list of no's of things that you can't do. It's about checking in with everybody and going, actually, here's a playground of yeses, that this is some boundaries on which we can explore. And also, it's work. It's a job. You want to feel like there are some ways to de-roll and leave your character behind. And that's really hard when you're really intimate with your colleague every day.
How do you navigate all those personalities? How do you go in and do that job?
Do you know, in the first bit of my training, the first thing you do is you learn your own boundaries, and you learn how to say no and how to say yes in a way that isn't about shutting things down. And I think that was the best part of my training. So being able to advocate for actors, being able to hear people's needs and their fears, and then also go, actually, we're here to create a really positive environment rather than one that is about getting in trouble. I'm in my 40s, so I think I'd find this harder if I was a lot younger, because I can go in and have some experience and work with lots of generations of actors. Mm. I usually find that if there is any kickback, well, not kickback, but hesitancy or fear, usually at the end of the process, a lot of those actors will come to me and say, do you know what? I'm so grateful for this. I'm going to tell you a horror story of something that happened to me in my career. And I hear a lot of those stories of people go, oh, if I'd had this when I was younger, I feel like I'd have better mental health, or I'd have a better approach to my work.
Yeah, how interesting. So people have just, if you know no different, you just go along with how it's always been done.
Yeah.
I'm wondering about that overlap between being a choreographer and being an intimacy director, because your job is to show people how to move their bodies, and often, you know, together in very, very close proximity.
Yeah.
Did it feel like a natural step for you?
It does. It is a natural step. And actually, my intimacy directing has informed my choreography quite a bit as well. So before, especially in choreography and in dance, you can just say, I'll just show you. Let me just show you this. And in intimacy directing, we don't do that because I have my own boundaries and I don't want to cross that line with a colleague as well. So you have to describe everything. So it's changed the way I work in that sense.
So you as a choreographer, you can't just take another trained dancer and...
Yes. Yeah, you can. You can in choreography, but I'd probably ask first.
Right.
So you can't do that in intimacy, but you can do it in choreography. But I feel like that's crossed over and I'd go, hey, do you mind if I dance with you here? Can I cut in here? And also about going, is there anything that you would like to offer as something that you don't want to do, or if you have any previous injuries, those crossovers are really useful. I mean, it's so obvious. It's about just checking in. But as an industry, we've taught our actors to just say yes to everything and say, right, you know, it's your job just to get on with it. And we just don't need to do that. We're creative people. We can take into account everybody's needs and make something that's really invests in the longevity of our actors.
And what about dancers?
Yeah, I mean, again, there is actually intimacy directing is slowly eking into the dance world. Again, dancers are told to get on with it, whether they're in pain or not, traditionally. And I used to be a dancer as well. So, and I think, especially in terms of the boundaries of their body, you have to just be used to being grabbed anywhere and everywhere in order to do those lifts and connect with people. But again, I think it's just about asking. And also, it's about being able to say no. Because I think in a room with such strong levels of hierarchy, and because of the nature of our self-employment, you want to get another job, right? So saying no comes with a risk, or even saying, could we try something else, comes with a risk.
Yeah, because you become the difficult one, or you don't want to do the job,
exactly.
And someone else will just come and do it. Yeah, all of that.
Exactly.
Especially if you're a woman, as we know.
Exactly.
And so you kind of describe yourself more of as a movement director then.
So choreography, I would say, is more for my musicals work, but I work in plays as well. So I do scene changes and body coaching and anything that's connected to the movement language on stage. Sometimes I just get to help actors with their character work. That also falls under the banner of movement. So it's a little bit more than choreography.
Well, and you've had a lot of fun doing Spend, Spend, Spend.
Oh, my goodness. It's such a joyful show.
I have to tell you, before I say goodbye, that when I saw that you worked on Girl from the North Country, every time I see anybody who works on this, I have to say, one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. It made me weep.
Thank you so much.
It was so great. So well done on that. And thank you for talking to me this morning. Spend, Spend, Spend continues at the Royal Exchange Theatre in Manchester until Saturday, the 11th of January next year. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
The local government ombudsman is demanding greater powers so that it can consider complaints about admissions and exclusions in academy schools. In a report setting out its plans for the next 3 years, it says the current rules, which only allow it to investigate local authority maintained schools but not academies, are neither logical nor fair. The ombudsman says parents have different levels of redress depending on which school their child attends. Well, in our special programme back in September, investigating the Special Educational Needs and Disabilities, or SEND system, one thing that got some of our audience shouting out of their seats in the BBC Radio Theatre as they listened to the Education Minister, Catherine McKinnell, was the issue of academies.
One of the things we do want to reform, and we're going to be legislating for it, is a change to the admission system. And that's fundamental as part of what we want to achieve. We want to reform the curriculum. We want to reform the way schools cooperate together with their local authorities, regardless of the nature of the school. And I know that's been raised, but everyone has a responsibility for the children in their area and have a duty to work together to make sure that every child gets the best start in life and every child gets that chance at their education, which we want to see.
Come in there,
Minister. That's
right. Yes. What did I miss there?
A duty to cooperate.
Not if they're at an academy.
That's what I'm saying.
That's some of the Women's Hour audience making their voices heard back in September, and we are here to amplify your voices. Since then, as promised, we've been continuing our investigations into the SEND system for children with special educational needs and disabilities. Today, we're looking at academies after more of you contacted us reporting negative experiences of academy schools for your children. Obviously, many academies are excellent with brilliant teachers and SEND staff, resulting in children and families who are exceptionally happy with the support they get. get if they have extra needs, but that's not everyone's experience. So we decided to find out what's going on. Joining me to discuss this and to explore how academies fit into the educational landscape is Leora Crudas, the CEO of the Confederation of School Trusts. Leora has been an English teacher, a SEND advisor, and also the Director of Education at two London local authorities. She's also advised successive governments and sits on several Department for Education advisory bodies. So, Leora, you're perfectly placed to talk to us this morning. Welcome to Women's Hour.
Good morning, Anita.
Good morning. We're getting lots of people messaging in already, but there's lots to get through. But let's start with setting out some facts. What is an academy school?
So, Anita, an academy school is a charitable organisation that runs a school or indeed a group of schools. So it's the charitable organisation rather than the local authority that runs the school. Now, that does not mean that the school doesn't work in its local authority. It, of course, does. All schools are rooted in their community. So that's an important thing to say. Another important thing to say is that all academy schools are state schools. So they're funded by the state in the same way that local authority schools are funded by the state. They're inspected by Ofsted in the same way. They have the same rules around admissions, for example. They must do the same tests and exams. So most academy schools work together in groups of schools called multi-academy trusts. And you gave some statistics at the beginning of Women's Hour talking about the number of secondary schools. That's about 4 in 5 secondary schools are academies, and around 43% of primary schools are academies. I should also say around 47% of special schools are academies. And most academies, most academy trusts are actually quite small. So they're very geographically located and really have a strong sense of being located in their communities, working closely with local authority schools and with the local authority.
So how do they differ then? What's the point of difference between them and a local authority school, which is also known as a maintained school?
A maintained school, yes. So the key difference is that the local authority does not maintain academy schools. The body that's responsible for academy schools is the Academy Trust, which, as I've said, is a charitable organisation. Yeah.
So can academies turn away children with SEND?
No, they cannot. The admissions code applies to all types of state schools equally. They definitely cannot. It is also fair to say, I think, on this point, that proportionately there are the same number of children with special educational needs in academies as in local authority schools.
OK, Leora, thank you for the moment, but please stay with us. As I said, we've been hearing from parents who say their children with SEND have had bad experiences at academy schools. Many say they feel broken by the system. One woman ended her long email saying, "Thank you for allowing me to download 14 years of trauma since becoming a SEND family." Another shared a letter she recently received from her academy saying it said it could no longer fund all SEND provision. And I quote, "We are in the dreadful position of having to cease any unfunded provision because there is no more flexibility in our budget." I'm going to read out a message that's just come in this morning. "I'm currently studying for a doctorate and my research focuses on how the academy agenda influences inclusion within schools. Young people with SEND are often an afterthought when these policies are rolled out. Seismic changes in the running of the education system need to consider the most vulnerable young people in the system and ensure that their inclusion is prioritised." We've also been contacted by mums whose children have ended up having to leave their academy schools because they say their needs haven't been met. The words of these two mothers have been spoken by actors to protect the identity of them and their children.
"My son has SEN needs which weren't supported in his academy school. I sent him in year 7, believing in the school being an outstanding school. But outstanding doesn't mean that SEND is outstanding, and his needs were viewed through a lens of behaviour, and therefore he could only ever be a problem. So the idea of SEN inclusivity is really a charade. There was just no communication between teachers, admin, and myself. I was only trying to protect my son, and it just got worse and worse and worse until he ended up being a shell of a child. He is academic, but in the academy, intelligence is only viewed in a very narrow way. And unfortunately, it is leading to the mental collapse of multiple SEN children and their families. It was the most crazy situation. Just trying to get just the basic education for a child who should have been able to get an education.
Both my children are in academies, in primary and secondary school, under the same multi-academy trust. The one in secondary is autistic, and her needs are fairly minimal and being met within SEN support. My youngest is a bit more complex. She's autistic and probably ADHD as well. My observation of being within an academy is that there's a very strong focus on the academic side of things. So what that has meant for both children is that if they are, or have been, meeting academic expectations, they were deemed not to have SEND. And the schools, both primary and secondary, were very reluctant to acknowledge the SEND needs and put them on the register. And so it was very difficult, particularly with my youngest, to get any acknowledgement that she had SEND in the early stages, because we were seeing signs of anxiety at home, but not in the school setting. It was very stressful. It was very difficult to deal with that and not feel like it was our parenting. We were seeing something at home that they weren't seeing in school, and it took a very long time for that to be recognised. It was only recognised when there was a change of head teacher who came from a non-academy setting. And I found that her understanding of SEND is much broader. She seemed to understand that it wasn't just about academics, that there was more to consider with the child's development and wider learning and education. So I think there's a strong argument to be had that academies seem to have a more difficult time in understanding and accepting SEND beyond the academics. I don't think funding is the main consideration of why there could be a difference, because I think mainstream settings, which aren't academies, are also facing those funding difficulties. They're also under that pressure to make money go as far as possible. I think there is something to be said about the culture differences and perhaps understanding of what SEND is and the definition of SEND and how to look at that. And I think that can be perpetuated particularly within a big corporation mindset that comes with multi-academy trusts. Even as evidence started to come in from other experts, including a community paediatrician, evidence which said this child's being overlooked because of her gender and, you know, possibly because of her age, that wasn't taken into consideration, again, because she was making progress academically. It felt like it was too little too late, and a year after being put on the SEND register, unfortunately, she was unable to cope and was no longer able to access school due to chronic stress after 3 years of trying to make the setting work. And no one's tried harder than the child. Now we find ourselves in the position of having a child who's outside of school. She's still on roll but unable to attend and receiving some alternative provision. And we are having to consider other school settings which might be better suited, and we'll probably have to go via tribunal to make sure that her plan and the setting is the correct place so that she can thrive and get a good education.
The best way to explain it is educational gaslighting. It was just weekly, constantly trying to solve a situation in a school that promotes itself as being inclusive. I would go as far to say I feel the school bullied my son and myself because he didn't fit the narrative and therefore neither did I. He's not good at all. We are still building him back as a person. And what I found was the children that needed the most received the least. And it was heartbreaking.
The experience of two of our listeners there. Well, we're still with Leora Crudas, the CEO of the Confederation of Schools Trust. Listening to the words of those mums, Leora, what do you make of their stories?
So, Anita, I'm really sad to hear about the experiences of those two mums and, of course, their children. This is horrible, and we must build a better system together where children don't end up in those situations and parents don't end up in those situations. So I really agree that our SEND system doesn't currently work well. but it doesn't work well for children in all types of schools. I don't think this is an issue for one type of school. It is an issue for all schools. And I'd like to say that in our recent survey, leaders in Academy Trust said that their number one priority in the system was ensuring inclusive education. So I think we need to work towards a system that is good for all of our children, for all of their parents, and for all of our schools. So I think we're in this together. All our children need to feel like they belong in our state schools, regardless of structure.
Yes. I'm sure people do want to ensure that it's an inclusive system. And you said that SEND asked you the question whether they can academies can turn away children with SEND, and you said absolutely not. So why are parents telling us that academies do turn their children away?
So I think there's a complex answer to this. Around 62% of state educated children in England are educated in academy schools. So that's a big proportion. That's the largest part of the school system in England is actually the academy system. So I think the strong likelihood is you are going to see proportionately more complaints then from the academy sector than perhaps from the local authority sector. But as I've said, I honestly don't think that this is about one type of school structure. So what I'd like to focus on is this is a system that is in need of our collective attention. It is a system that is not working and a system that needs to be fixed.
But we are focusing a little bit on academies this morning, and we are covering this from all different angles. Are academies too focused on academic success at the expense of some children with SEND?
So first of all, I think I need to say probably that I think a focus on academic results is not a bad thing. It helps children to the next stage of life, and I'm sure that most parents would actually agree with that statement. But I would agree that this should not come at the expense of the well-being of our children. And we heard Minister McKinnell at the beginning of the programme, and again in the clip that you played earlier, talking about that. This Secretary of State, Bridget Phillipson, wants a system where all children both achieve and thrive. And I think that's a great vision for our education system. And I think it also sets a sort of new political narrative. So we haven't heard that word thrive, or we haven't heard conversations about the need for our children to flourish in our schools for quite a long time. So I think there's a big opportunity for us to work together to create a system that does work well for all children, where all our children feel like they belong, and where our system of special educational needs is based not on deficit constructions of what children can't do or how children fail, but actually that we put dignity and belonging at the heart of the system that we build together.
This is a very important subject for our audience, so I'm going to put some of our listener questions to you, if I may. One listener whose child is at an academy school emailed us saying the child is not getting the one-to-one support set out in her education healthcare plan, which is the legal document. Can an academy ignore an EHCP?
No, they can't. No type of school can ignore an EHCP, because an EHCP is a legally binding document. There are ways in which parents can raise their concerns if they feel that their child is not getting the support that's in the legal document. An EHCP offers greater legal protection than perhaps a child that doesn't have an education, health and care plan. So no type of school can ignore what a legal document requires of them.
Another mum emailed to say she spent 10 years battling to get her son's needs met at his academy, but complaints and appeals fall on deaf ears. 10 years. I mean, you know, that's most of his education. We reported at the beginning of this piece, Leora, that the local government ombudsman wants more power so it can deal with complaints about academies. It says the current system is not logical and fair. What do you think? Is that a good idea?
So So one of the difficulties that we've got in state education in England is we're running two systems of state education. We're running a local authority school system and an academy school system. And the routes for redress, the routes for complaints, are different in those two different types of systems. Now, that's not ideal, I recognise that. And parents find that really hard to navigate. So we need to do better, don't we? But it's not true and it's not fair to say that there's no redress for parents in academy schools. There is a form of redress. It's actually through the Department for Education. Mm. But that's not that helpful to parents who find it difficult to navigate the system.
I'm going to go to a text just has come in from Ben Palmer, who says the statutory guidance related to directing children off-site to improve behaviour does not apply to academies. This means some children are off-rolled with no educational provision and abandoned. This leaves vulnerable students, including those with SEND, with little support, even if they have an EHCP, and often does not meet its duties under the legal legislation. What do you think? What do you say to that as a local authority?
So I think this term off-rolling needs a little bit of explanation, if that's all right with you, Anita.
Yes, of course, yeah.
So the Ofsted definition of off-rolling is actually quite simple. So Ofsted says off-rolling is the practice of removing a pupil from a school roll without using a permanent exclusion when that removal is in the best interest of the school rather than the best interests of the pupils. So there's no actual legal definition of off-rolling. But interestingly, in 2019, Ofsted wrote a really important blog which set out how they intended to inspect schools in relation to off-rolling. So they said, we know the disadvantaged pupils, those with special educational needs, those with low prior attainment, are more likely to be off-rolled in this way, using their definition. And they made a commitment through their inspection framework in 2019 to look at this when they inspect schools. Now, again, I would say that off-rolling, unfortunately, sadly, has been found, or was found by Ofsted, in all types of school structures. It's less and less found now because Ofsted included it in their inspection framework in 2019. So I hope that helps. I think we're getting to a better place.
Leora, there's so many questions still coming in. We'll have to get you back in to discuss them at some point because there's lots more. And, you know, you've advised governments, you've sat in education at the highest level for such a long time. I think you will have, no doubt, lots more to say on this. So we'll put another date in. Leora Krodas, for now, thank you so much, the CEO of the Confederation of Schools Trust. Please keep your questions and thoughts coming in because we are collating them. And as you know, we will be coming back to this very important subject. But now, actually, I'm going to introduce my next guest, just read a message that's come in straight from Sue Davis. And she says, saw Kim Cipher and her band perform in Ross on Wye last week. Captivating. I haven't felt so alive in a long time. How about that, Kim?
Oh, that's amazing.
Isn't that good?
Oh, hi, Sue.
I'm going to come back to you, but before I do, I just need to read out a statement, if I may. The Department of Education spokesperson said, every child and young person deserves the best life chances and the opportunity to achieve and thrive, which is why we announced a significant £1 billion investment into the SEND system in the budget. But in a system that is so skewed towards specialist provision and over-reliance on EHC plans, it's often only families who have the resources to fight that can get the right support. We're determined to rebuild families' confidence in a system so many rely on. The reform families are crying out for it will take time, but with a greater focus on our mainstream provision and more intervention, we will deliver the change that is so desperately needed. Back to you, Kim. I'm going to intro you properly. Funky saxophonist meets 1940s jazz singer is the way my next guest has been described. Saxophonist, composer, vocalist, regular performer on the London and UK jazz circuit, including sold-out performances at Ronnie Scott's. But it could have been so different for you, couldn't it? Because you were a primary school teacher for 17 years, Kim.
A previous life of mine, yes, primary school teacher.
Take us back to the beginning then. Before all of that, where did your love of jazz come about?
Well, so, I mean, I've always loved music. I don't know, you know, from an early age, I just felt that I could go up to any instrument and just, I was drawn to it, you know, I wanted to pick it up and play it. And my mum and dad always had big band music going on. My dad used to stand in the lounge and pretend to conduct the band, you know, so there was music all the time at home.
How magic.
I know, it was wonderful. And then one year my sister and I were bought a piano, and I just remember going up to it and thinking, oh yeah, play some melodies on the piano. So it kind of started from there, and it just became this kind of almost obsession with music. And when I found the saxophone, it was just like that moment of like, wow.
What was it? Because people often say it's the hardest thing to pick up. What was it about the saxophone?
Oh, I don't know. I think because I went through, you know, the usual instruments like recorder, and I dabbled a bit on the piano, and then I played the clarinet. But for me, they weren't funky enough. They weren't enough to allow me that sort of slightly rebellious kind of expression. And when I found the sax, it was just like, yes, now you're talking.
You're so right. Funky and rebellious. It's not a coincidence that Lisa Simpson plays the sax.
I know.
It's so cool. And then you went off and you met your husband, Mike.
Yes.
It's a reason we mentioned him, because he's in the room. He's going to be playing
indeed.
In the band. But then it was and he went into banking.
Yeah.
He went into teaching.
Yeah.
And then decided to change your lives completely.
Well, we did. I mean, we both loved music from an early age, and we were always in bands. We met in the Gloucestershire Youth Jazz Orchestra when we were 15. And I think, you know, that was always kind of the path we wanted to take. But I think...
So why not?
Well, so I think back in the day, if you said you wanted a career in music, they didn't really know what to do with you. You know, what do you mean a career in music? It's a hobby. So my career advice was with insurance companies and banks. And I did actually work in a bank for a year. And then I realised that that wasn't the route for me. So I ended up training to be a teacher purely because the course was expressive arts. So it allowed me to play and compose and do other expressive creative things. And which filtered me into the primary school role, which I absolutely loved. You know, working with the children and doing music, it was wonderful.
And we started the programme, you know, we had that huge lengthy debate, the conversation about children with special educational needs. Presumably, yeah. And within your classroom,
absolutely.
Children thrived.
Yeah, well, it was
or
just,
not.
Yeah, I mean, but the thing is with all children can do music,
yeah.
You know, and this is what the beauty of the arts is that, you know, all children can do it in their own way. They've got to be allowed that freedom. But you know, it's difficult because when you're in a classroom and you want to create music, you have to have noise. And of course, all the other teachers would be like, oh, can you keep the noise down a bit? It's like, well, no, we can't. We're making music.
Wonderful. Bring the noise. All children can do music. You haven't heard me play recorder.
Oh, I feel we need to.
No, no one needs to hear that. And then I also need to ask you about this. I read that you recently turned down at a local music festival because they said they already had a female saxophonist. What was your response to that?
It was shock, I think. Well, I'm part of something called Women in Jazz Media, which is founded by a good friend of mine, Fiona Ross. So we're all about kind of, you know, women can do just as well. but it's a bit more of a struggle, perhaps, in the world of, you know, music. So I was quite taken aback. I won't name and shame, but yeah, it was a festival I've played at before. I always go down an absolute storm. And yeah, they said they wouldn't book me because they already had one of those.
Shocking.
Yeah, and the stupid thing is that, you know, just because we're female sax players, we're not all the same. You know, we're
it's
all
different.
It's funny
that, aren't you? Well, we're going to hear that right now.
Ooh.
We're going to hear you perform.
Are
I'm
we?
Very excited. Would you like to
yeah.
go and take your place? I'm very excited about this. In fact, when I walked in, the studio manager said, you're going to be dancing today, Anita. I'm very ready for a bit of a dance today. So this is from their third album. It's called Catching Moments. And the piece is called Bertie, Bertie, Bertie. It's about your rabbit. I'll let you tune up and get your reed ready. And whilst you're doing that, I'm going to introduce you to the rest of the band. The musicians are Mike Green on electric bass, Richard Hughes on piano, and Kim's husband, Mike Cypher, on drums. Yes! Oh, Kim, that was so good. Who's Bertie, by the way? Bertie, Bertie, Bertie?
Oh, Bertie, my rabbit. Well, one of my rabbits, Bertie. Don't tell Molly Moo.
She'll get jealous.
She will.
And we've had a message in from Sarah saying, yay, music for smiling and dancing.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you. So thank you to Kim Cypher, who is on saxophone. Brilliant. Mike Cypher on drums. Mike Green on electric bass. Richard Hughes on piano. And you can find out more about the new album, Catching Moments, and forthcoming tour on the website. It's kimcypher.com.
Thank
what
you.
A joy for a Thursday. Thank you so much. And thanks to all of you with your messages. Another one here, I'll email. John Moore emailed to say, the evidence highlights how our educational system is centred on a misplaced objective, academic success, rather than helping to create balanced skills. skilled and confident people. As a society, we're failing our children with this narrow perspective and system. Please keep your thoughts and opinions coming in. You can continue to do so by emailing our website. And do join me tomorrow for more Woman's Hour. I'm going to be joined by the soprano Marina Costa-Jackson, who's making her debut with the Royal Opera in a new production of The Tales of Hoffman. She'll be speaking about her struggles with performance anxiety and more music. She's going to sing for us live. And Maggie O'Farrell will be talking about her third children's book, When the Stammer Came to Stay. Do join me then. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Join us again next time.
Hello, this is Marion Keyes.
And this is Tara Flynn.
We host a podcast you might like for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds called Now You're Asking.
Each week we take real listeners' questions about life,
love,
lingerie,
cats,
dogs,
dentists,
pockets,
or the lack of
anything really,
and apply our worldly wisdom in a way which we hope will help,
but also hopefully entertain. Join us, why don't you?
Search up Now You're Asking
on BBC Sounds.
Tankin' you.